I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. An hour from now, Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott is convening for the first time a meeting of his gun violence reduction strategy partners. They come from across city agencies, and they'll be the linchpin of the mayor's efforts to curb violence on our city streets. At the heart of these efforts are violence interruption programs like Safe Streets and ROCA, in which counselors reach out to people at risk of being the victims of violence or committing violence. Safe Streets works to de-escalate beefs between folks so that the outcomes are peaceful. ROCA offers counseling services and job training as alternatives to criminal activity. These programs will receive increased funding. But do they work? Today on Midday, we'll look at the data with Dr. Jeffrey Butts of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Amos Gelb and Latrina Antoine of Baltimore Witness. First, the news. Thanks, Andy, and thanks to everybody who has stepped up so far in our first day here of the fall membership campaign. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Glad you are along for the ride. It's been 11 days in a row now that we've had more than 1,000 new cases of coronavirus here in Maryland. Pfizer BioNTech announced that it has tested a lower dose of its coronavirus vaccine in children ages 5 to 11, and they have found it to be safe and effective. Vaccine may be available for younger children by the end of next month. Beginning in early November, anyone from another country flying into the U.S. will be required to prove that they are vaccinated. Unvaccinated Americans returning to the U.S. will be required to take a test before they leave the country they're in and when they return to the United States. Today on Midday, we're going to have a conversation about the violence that persists on our city streets and what can be done about it. Last week, four children were injured when gunfire erupted in a largely blighted block off North Milton Avenue in the Broadway East neighborhood. One girl was 17, two were 14-year-old twins, the other victim was a 12-year-old boy. They were among the more than 500 people who have been injured in shootings in our city this year. 245 people have been killed in Baltimore. Over the summer, Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott published his Comprehensive Violence Prevention Plan, the product of community meetings and a multi-agency approach that treats violence as a public health issue and seeks to engage the community in addressing it. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the mayor is convening his gun violence reduction strategy partners for the first time this afternoon. At the heart of these efforts is a push for prevention. Programs that employ violence interrupters, groups like Safe Streets and ROCA, will be expanded. Other similar community-based programs will be developed, and funding will be increased. So what do we know about the efficacy of these programs? When a Safe Streets outreach worker intervenes in a dispute and turns people who are arguing about something away from violent resolution of the conflict, is that something that can be tracked and quantified easily? It's hard to collect data on events that haven't happened. Well, today on Midday, we'll talk about the effectiveness of violence interruption programs. I'm joined by three people who collect data about this and study the issue from different perspectives. Dr. Jeffrey Butts is a research professor and the director of the Research and Evaluation Center at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, and he joins us on Zoom. Dr. Butts, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Thanks for your time. And Amos Gelb is the director of the Washington Media Institute and the publisher of Baltimore Witness, an organization that tracks those accused of violent crimes through the judicial system. And he joins us on Zoom as well. Mr. Gelb, welcome.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
And Latrina Antoine, she is the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Witness, whose focus is on the data and on the reporting that her staff does about violence and the court system. She as well is on Zoom. Miss Antoine, welcome to you as well.
Hello there. Good afternoon.
So, Dr. Butts, let me start with you. How would you assess the current status of the data about these violence interruption programs, things like Safe Streets and ROCA? Generally speaking, what's the verdict according to the data so far?
Well, we carefully use the word promising when we talk about this. So policymakers like to rush to the words evidence-based, but a researcher reserves that phrase for something very specific. But when we have enough research showing the potential of positive effects and some consistency from study to study, we start to use the word promising, which means this is something potentially valuable. It's an asset that should be nurtured and grown, and we should continue to do rigorous studies on it to narrow in on the actual effect size. And we're not there yet, but I think it certainly merits the term promising and worthwhile.
Is it, to your reckoning, full enough? Is it complete enough? Do we know enough? Have these programs been in place for long enough, and have they been studied properly for long enough to be able to give us really solid information?
Even using the term these programs, it reveals the problem that there's so many different models and approaches. And even in one place that claims to have multiple sites doing the same thing, you'll find differences between them. And when you're trying to measure the effects of an intervention, that just makes everything so much more complicated when everyone's innovating and creating their own thing. And the example I use for people is when you walk into a major store like a Starbucks, you know exactly what they offer, what it looks like, you know what the prices are. We are nowhere near being able to walk into one of these violence prevention programs and know what we're in for, because the people who work there may have innovated and created their own approach. And so it's really hard to say whether these programs are effective, because they're all slightly different.
And Amos Gelb, you and your colleague Latrina Antoine published a piece in the Washington Post this summer at the end of July about the experience that Washington, D.C. has had with these violence interrupter programs. And you state categorically that they aren't doing what they claim. Why not? And what do you mean by that assertion?
So in D.C., and we don't have the data yet in Baltimore to do the same kind of thing. In D.C., the claims have been, they're all political. A lot of them are driven by political rhetoric, which is a bit unfair, but they're driven by political rhetoric. And in D.C., the idea is that these programs have been incredibly successful at reducing the level of violence in these communities. And the problem is that while they may actually provide reductions, what our data showed, as we actually grabbed the data, and it was, what it showed was that while they may have reduced it at some of the sites that they were in, the very narrow post-stamped area that they were working, what we found was that homicides moved into areas just around those sites, and the number increased across the city. So rather than reducing, they were dispersing the crime, the violence. So it was, and the bigger problem that we had was that everybody was saying they're working, but nobody was providing any data that showed it. And I got to be clear, by the way, off the start, and we were attacked for some of this, is that we're not against violence interrupters. I think it's a great idea, especially for returning citizens. The problem is how they're evaluated, which isn't very well. And when you look at a site, are you looking at the whole city and the impact overall in Baltimore? Because we know in Baltimore, the homicide rate keeps going up. And so even if they're doing really well in a neighborhood, how does that fit into the greater scheme of the city and the efforts?
Yeah, and Latrina Antoine, your colleague, Amos, is exactly right. The homicide numbers do keep going up. We're ahead here in Baltimore of where we were last year on this date. Walk us through what Baltimore Witness is doing. How are you peeling this apple? As Dr. Butts, you know, alluded to, different researchers do things in different ways, and there are different programs, and you have to ask perhaps different questions. What questions are you asking, and give us the sort of the mission of Baltimore Witness and how you're approaching this?
Gladly. So really the mission of Baltimore Witness is to provide transparency on the criminal justice system, the entire criminal justice system. And how we will approach this is that we are actually going in person and to all of the cases that involve homicides and non-fatal shootings in Baltimore. And we are getting an accurate account of what's happening in the court proceedings that are going on. And we're tracking each and every one of these cases, and we're keeping this robust database of these cases really to have this one place where all of this information, which is really not gathered, is being collected and gathered so that we can give it to the community. We can give it out to organizations working on preventing violent crime, so that there is a metric that is so we can have one metric. Because as the doctor was right, he was very right. You know, there are so many different programs out here, and each of them focus on different aspects and different measurements. So we use we provide the metrics of the courts of the criminal justice system as one solid metric that these programs can use.
Latrina Antoine and Amos Gelbar with Baltimore Witness. Dr. Jeffrey Butts is with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. We're talking about the efficacy of violence interrupter programs in particular, and strategies to reduce violence on city streets like those of Baltimore. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number, and this is a different phone number than you use to make a pledge to support WIPR, the midday number, 410-662-8780. You can email us, midday@wipr.org, and you can get us on Twitter @MiddayWIPR. And Jeffrey Butts, when we talk about collecting data about violence interrupter programs like Safe Streets, it does seem as a matter of common sense that it would be difficult to track stuff that doesn't happen. When I've had folks from Safe Streets on this program, it's been very encouraging to hear them say that they think in some years it's as many as 900 disputes have been diffused and de-escalated so that they didn't involve violence. They didn't end in, retribution killings. And we hear from the police department that so many of the killings that happen in Baltimore are based in a beef that two people or more have between each other. What do you make of those claims? I mean, is this something that you all have studied at the John Jay College? How do we parse the validity and credibility of claims about numbers of cases, you know, that were diffused so that nothing happened?
Well, that's how they market themselves and promote their approach, and that's fine. And I think Mr. Gelb referred to the politics of this. And I think that the advocacy for this approach to public safety plays a large role in this. But what we should not do is allow the advocacy to replace or stand for evidence. It kind of broke my heart during the White House meeting a couple months ago when President Biden pronounced community-based approaches to violence prevention as evidence-based, because that's set such a high standard. And I said to my colleagues, this is just setting up these programs for someone to come after them. And it doesn't take long for someone to start poking holes in these arguments. So talking about how many things we've prevented is may work at a hearing with the city council, but it's not something that a scientist is going to accept as evidence. And so what we do is, first of all, this is a very high standard for programs to meet, which is, did the neighborhood experience fewer shootings or homicides after the program launched compared to the pattern before? And that's tricky also. You don't just want to do pre-post. You don't want to say last year we had 46 shootings and before we opened the program there were 68. So therefore, look what we did. Because even that is not sufficient evidence, because numbers fluctuate, they go up and down, and you have to control for all that up and downness before you say we made a difference.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. In other words, numbers fluctuate. In other words, any given year may have different numbers of shootings, even if there isn't a program of community violence interrupting. So how can you control for that? Because that's fairly random, isn't it, from year to year?
Yeah, and so you control for that by collecting as much data as possible. So in New York, for example, we looked at communities, small area communities also. You can't do this in a very large scale. You have to look at small neighborhoods. And so we looked at neighborhoods that opened up these cure violence style programs and had data for 6 years prior and sometimes 2 or 3 years after. And we used the pattern of data that pre-exists the program to establish the expected trend. And then you look and see if that trend seemed to move down after the program launched. And sometimes we found, yes, it did, and sometimes by significant margins.
We're talking about violence interrupter programs and their efficacy in the effort to reduce violence in cities like Baltimore. Amos Gelb and Latrina Antoine of Baltimore Witness are with us, as is Dr. Jeffrey Butts of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. We'll have more with our guests in just a little bit, but first, Andy Bienstock joins me on this first day of our fall membership campaign. It is easy to become part of the public radio family here in Maryland, and Andy can tell us how to do that.
It's real easy. Doesn't take very long. Just go to WYPR.org and click the donate link, or call us at 410-235-1395. We'd love for you to become a member today, the very first day of our fall play. Pledge Drive, a day we're asking you to take responsibility for your listening and asking you to help us bring you information, ideas, and insight every day. Your $10 a month pays for trustworthy, fact-based news at a time that you and your community really need it. We need your help to keep doing it, so come to WYPR.org, click the donate link, and make your pledge.
And thanks, Andy. Thanks again to everybody who has made a pledge so far in our fall membership campaign. We really appreciate it. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow here on our program, Fear of Flying. And the ones who are afraid these days are the flight crews. There have been more than 700 FAA investigations into incidents involving unruly passengers just this year. I'll speak with Sarah Nelson. She's the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, and Captain Dennis Tager. He's a spokesman for the American Pilots Association. So that's on the way tomorrow here on Midday. And I'll also speak with the author Dawn Ouellette about her new novel, Mango Samba. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about violence interruption programs like Safe Streets and ROCA here in Baltimore, and what happens in the criminal justice system when violent crimes do occurred. Dr. Jeffrey Butts is the director of the research and evaluation center at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Amos Gelb and Latrina Antoine are in the senior leadership of Baltimore Witness, an investigative journalism organization whose mission is to increase transparency about the criminal justice system. If you'd like to weigh in with our conversation, if you've had experience in the Safe Streets or ROCA realm, let us know. 410-662-8780. That's the different number for making a pledge. That's the midday number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @midday_WYPR. So, Amos Gelb, when you go to the Baltimore Witness website, which I recommend everybody do, there is a heartbreaking list of people who have been victims of homicide and crimes here in Baltimore. And then next to that list are the names of people who are suspected in the crimes. And there are many, many of the names on the list that next to it simply says unknown. In other words, we don't currently, the police are not pursuing any particular suspects in these crimes. Is there any data yet anywhere, whether in D.C. or Baltimore or any other place you know of, about strategies that increase the clearance rates, you know, in other words, strategies that lead to more suspects and lead to more solving of the crimes that are taking place?
That's a fascinating question. We haven't been tracking that yet. And frankly, that's sort of a question for the fine professor, Dr. Butts there, because really we gather the data and we can diagnose what they're doing and we track policies as they're implemented. So far, you know, in DC, part of the problem is that everybody is, and it's my term for it is, everybody's looking for an Amazon Prime solution. So in DC, for example, the police came out and said it's all about illegal guns without looking at some of the tangential issues that there's a culture of violence and people are frightened and they're going to carry guns. So if you get rid of the guns in DC, you just create a greater market. Have we seen anything that, to your direct questions, is there anything that speeds up the clearance rate? No, we haven't. In Baltimore, we know that the state's attorney, Ms. Mosby, is very proud of the data she presents. And one of the things that we're going to be looking to do as we continue to gather data is to see whether she's actually right, whether her policies have worked or not. But we don't yet have that data. I mean, we're dependent on the courts opening up to follow the cases. And so we want to be able to do that now as the courts are starting to open up. But maybe this is, maybe Trina, have you seen anything else in the data? I'll pass it to my colleague.
So we have, as far as, again, what Amos said, as far as deciding if these programs can be enhanced, we haven't seen that yet. Frankly, we haven't been collecting data long enough, and nor have we focused precisely on different tactics that the police department or the government is taking when they do make arrests. What we have been tracking, as we did initially start some months ago, is we have been tracking the overall environment. So we can tell you what the arrest rate looked like during the summer, which was, there was a 33% arrest rate from May to August in Baltimore. And we are tracking that along with tracking common statistics on both the victims and the suspects as it relates to the criminal justice process, so that we can then get a better footing to help provide real statistical data for evaluating the several programs that are out here and for simply diagnosing issues within the system to help alleviate the city of these violent crimes.
And if I take the note, as Trina said, we've got a 33% closure rate. That means that right now, if you're in the community and you're doing this, you know you've got a 66% chance of not getting caught if you do violence.
Sure, and that rate does fluctuate. I mean, there are times, yes, you know, that's as high as 50%. It's been as low as, you know, 30%. Commissioner Michael Harrison, the commissioner of the Baltimore Police Department, got it up into the mid-60s when he was in New Orleans. That's Latrina Antoine and Amos Geld there with Baltimore Witness. Dr. Jeffrey Butts is with the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about violence interruption programs. And Dr. Butts, one of the statements that is in the John Jay College's most recent report, which came out last year, is that when it comes to the body of research in this realm, there are a couple that are pretty old, one from 2009 in Chicago, one from 2015. But you say that the research consists of correlational work and they have no randomized controlled trials, which is the gold standard for evidence. What would it take? What would a randomized controlled trial in the realm of violence interruption look like?
Well, in a fantasy world where the government values this so highly that they're willing to do whatever it takes, you would have a randomized controlled trial of communities. Let's say 30 small area neighborhoods get intensive help to build these programs and 30 do not, that are just like the 30 that do, and you flip a coin to decide who gets the program and who doesn't. But the problem with that fantasy world is you would only consider a program in a community suffering from gun violence. And it's just unethical to randomly decide that some people don't get help for a couple of years while you do your science. So it really, you've touched one of my nerves when you say that a random controlled trial is the gold standard. People do say that, but politicians say that. Researchers say it when they're trying to sell you a random controlled trial. But there are some important policy questions involving public safety that it's either just impractical or unethical to do a randomized controlled trial. And so we need other rigorous methods. And I could bore you endlessly by telling you what those rigorous methods are, but it's just you have to have a little flexibility when you're looking at this question.
Yeah, it's complicated, isn't it? It really is very complex. And Latrina Antoine, when it comes to, you know, the basic premise of something like Safe Streets, it certainly does seem, certainly seems to me at least, that it's an excellent way of trying to reduce violence, and perhaps one of the arrows in the quiver that you can have, one of several. But when it comes to, you know, talking to folks and saying, look, you know, I know you're mad at this guy, but here's an alternative to resolving your argument without violence. And when the person doing that conversation has been in prison, when a person has experience with law enforcement, a bad interaction with law enforcement, when a person's been convicted of a crime of violence and has lived that life, the credibility is certainly much higher than it would be for any number of other people to go into the community and try to initiate those conversations. I mean, there is some evidence, isn't there, that, and I wondered if the data in D.C. that you've done more extensive work on than, because you're just getting started here in Baltimore, but there is some evidence, is there not, that is, you know, a persuasive modus operandi.
So, as Amos said, like in some areas in DC specifically that we have tracked, we have seen homicides go down in those areas where violence interrupter programs have been placed. And in other areas, we've actually seen it gone up. When we're in court, we have established that there is a gun culture in DC and that we have seen that a lot of this gun culture actually moves from fear of being a victim themselves. And so a lot of them carry a lot of, I don't want to say young people, but a lot of people, because in DC, we see that the average age of the suspect and the victim, well, they're in their late 20s to mid 30s. So it's really a lot of time has to go into this. But what we really say is a lot of data tracking has to go into this. And that's something in DC that we did not see happening as far as to determine the neighborhoods and then to keep trying to determine, are these effective areas of where we're placing these violence interrupters?
That's Latrina Antoine, along with her colleague Amos Gelb. They are with Baltimore Witness. Dr. Jeffrey Butts is a researcher at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Coming up, we will have more with our guests. But first, we want to take a minute to remind you that today is the first day of our fall membership campaign. Here's Andy Bienstock to tell you how you can get involved.
Just come to WIPR.org and click the donate link. It's that simple. You'll become a member of WIPR. Remember, your support helps create the radio community that is WIPR. Shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered keeping you informed. Shows like Midday and 1A, where you can lend your voice to the conversation. And the Maryland-focused work of our WIPR news team in reports throughout the day and on our Daily Dose podcast. Make a pledge now on this first day of our short fall pledge drive. WIPR.org. Just click the donate link.
Hey And thanks to everybody who has stepped up on this first day of our fall membership campaign. We are very, very grateful. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our topic today is violence interruption as a strategy to reduce the violence that plagues many neighborhoods in our cities and in many cities across the country. The two most well-known programs here are called ROCA and Safe Streets. They employ different methods, but the premise of their work is similar. They target people who are at risk of violence or at risk of committing violence. We'll try to take some calls in these last few minutes of our conversation with our guests, Dr. Jeffrey Butts of the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, Amos Gelb, he's the publisher and founder of Baltimore Witness, and Latrina Antoine, she's the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Witness. 410-662-8780. Our email's midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. And Amos Gelb, we have some calls and callers, and I want to get to that. But I wonder, it is inextricable, the relationship between affection for, support for the violence interruption programs and the defund the police movements that have taken off in many cities around the country. It's interesting to see that in a lot of those cities, sometimes efforts to defund the police, I'm thinking of Minneapolis in particular, have been scaled back since they were originally asked. But there is absolutely a political dimension to how people perceive these violence interrupting programs. And I guess what you're trying to do in Baltimore Witness is clear the fog away and just rely on the hard facts. Is that a fair assessment of what you're trying to do? Amos, can you hear me? So Amos, I'm asking you to comment on the correlation between the defund the police movement that's taken hold in a lot of cities around the country and the violence interrupting programs.
Wow. Oh boy, you just want to dip me in that hot water, don't you?
Indeed.
Why don't you bring some feathers and tar along and I can be interesting question. It goes to the unfortunate the politicization of it. My violence interrupters per se aren't bad. And there's a range of them, and it depends how you run. But the problem is they can get looped into that whole argument, which turns off people who might otherwise support them. That's probably where I'll go, if that's okay.
And let's go to the phones. On that note, let's go to Joyce, who's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. It's a great topic that you have. And this, I guess, is for Dr. Butts, but any of the other panelists. Talking about the hard data of violence interruption programs, and in that I also include the hospital responders, the guys that, catch the people in the emergency room and bedside right before things pop. I wonder if some other indicators that you have found to be effective, that we've seen are effective in Baltimore, there's about four of them. And one of them is simply baseline resilience. Some of the perpetrators and victims who are involved in these violent incidents, do they get into therapy? One, so there's some resilience there. Two, looking at incidents of rearrest or reincarceration 6 months to a year out, that's pretty powerful to see if these same people get reinvolved in the criminal justice system. Maybe a longer term one is, do any of these men and sometimes women rejoin the local economy after intervention, hospital bedside, or in a street violence program? So those are some of the ones. I kind of wondered if you can comment on those rather than the 8,000-yard view of, homicide data, which obviously, as we all know on this call, and that has a lot of variables other than the people.
Dr. Butts, what do you think?
Well, those are all interesting questions, but the challenge is, if what you've done in this question is frame it as an individual level intervention where you work with specific people to try to modify their behavior or turn their lives around. And that's not what these programs are set up to do. I think it's the conventional frame that people use to talk about public safety, but the value of these programs, it's a public health approach, which is couple things, but one of them is resetting the norms in a neighborhood so that young people just don't see it as attractive to carry a gun around, and they don't see violence as the way to solve disputes. But if you only test that at the individual level by enlisting particular people in your program, you're turning that into a clinical program. Now, you will get solid statistics that way because it's easier to measure individual level change. But what the programs are set up to do is to move the neighborhood, to change the neighborhood. And that's why they're more difficult to evaluate. Ideally, of course, you'd be approaching this from a variety of fronts and using different data sources to test each thing. But I'm always concerned when, because policymakers do this a lot, they take any discussion of a public safety, public health approach and turn it into therapy and individual level interventions. And that may be helpful for some people, but it's not going to change the environment and the community enough to really achieve the public safety goals that we're all after.
If I may sort of pick up on where the good professor just said, and going back to his start and in answer to your call into the caller, the thing is that these programs, as we've come to see, is there's a variety of them. So ROCA and Safe Streets are very different organizations. ROCA does do a lot with CBT, with behavioral intervention. And so there is some tracking on that, but this is where I think the, in defense of Mayor Scott, the idea is you help 100, 200 young men. Well, there are almost as many young men who are now unfortunately deceased. So is it the scale? Can you scale that? And by the way, in answer to your to the caller, we actually are tracking many of those things to see. We're tracking the names if they come back into court, whether there's recidivism, over what time, since we're ongoing and there at every trial, every hearing of every case, we're hopefully going to be able to gather that kind of data to be able to answer exactly the kind of question that caller asked.
Yeah.
And if I could add to that, just a quick note. And we have also reviewed and spoken, especially with people from some of these programs, especially ROCA, and with their CBT approach. One focus that they do look on is the economic aspect of it. And what I've heard is that getting a job is, even though it is a challenge, the biggest challenge that face a lot of these individuals is keeping said employment.
Yeah, and I want to make sure our listeners understand that the premise of Baltimore Witness is to follow these cases through the court system. Lots of times we hear, for example, in the case of Safe Streets, we've heard about the deaths of two Safe Streets outreach workers over the past several months. One of them, Dante Barksdale, a beloved figure in the anti-violence community here. There has been an arrest in the case of Dante Barksdale. So a person has been charged. But oftentimes, we hear, well, this guy died. He was a Safe Streets outreach worker. Then a few months later, there's been an arrest in the case, and then you don't hear anything about it. It's going to be a while until this person comes to trial for the murder of Dante Barksdale. But Baltimore Witness will be there and covering it. Now, perhaps the Baltimore Sun and other news outlets will be doing it as well, because Dante was such a prominent figure. But it's also the case that so many of these cases don't get covered by the press because the Sun and the Baltimore Brew and the Afro don't have the resources to do it, but Baltimore Witness will have a reporter in the courtroom for all of them. Let's see if we can get one more call in before our time is up. Let's go to Tom, who's in Mount Vernon. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. This is for Dr. Butts. I have an article in front of me from the Washington Post in 2019, an interview with David Kennedy, probably a colleague of yours, a criminologist at John Jay College, who pioneered an initiative in the 1990s that was successful at reducing violence in cities like Boston, Oakland, California, and Cincinnati. But when he tried to replicate it in Baltimore, first in the 1990s and again more recently in 2019, it failed. He said because the city has a singularly toxic and dysfunctional political culture. Dr. Butts, can you comment on that?
Well, yes, David Kennedy is a colleague. His approach, of course, is not this approach. It's different. They partner at the neighborhood level with law enforcement, and the programs we're talking about are designed to operate not in opposition to law enforcement, but apart from and to work maybe at a distance in collaboration, but not closely. And that's of great value because if you think about predominantly young people, predominantly young men are involved in these acts of especially gun violence. They are not likely to sit and listen to a bunch of adults they don't know lecture them about their behavior. What you need is people who they trust and understand, who know the life they live and come from the same neighborhoods to reach out to them. And you cannot do that in close coordination with law enforcement because the people you're most trying to reach will just not trust you. And so it's just a different approach. You need multiple vectors in order to reach the problem and try to improve public safety.
And Trina Antoine, the meeting that is going to take place in about 7 minutes here in Baltimore that Mayor Scott has convened, this is the group of what he calls partners in this effort to reduce violence. It's a huge group of people. It's 76 some people are on the list to attend this meeting. They include people from the mayor's office, the police department, the state's attorney's office, including the chief of police and the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby. There are scholars, this guy named Anthony Braga, who studies this. There are people from the U.S. Attorney's Office, the DOJ, ATF, FBI, DEA, you name the acronym, somebody's going to be there. It's a huge group of people. In your reporting in Washington, when it comes to political corruption, et cetera, and political will, the mayor has long made a point that the difference between his efforts now and the efforts that happened previously is that they didn't have political will in the past, and he's going to make sure they have the political will now. Do you think that's going to be, based on your reporting and your experience, that that's going to be enough to turn the tide this time?
To be honest with you, I think that it's great that all of these people are getting into the same room, but again, they're from several different agencies and organizations with several different perspectives and points of view. And there needs to be more data, I think, around this entire situation. There just needs to be more data, or the pendulum will not move forward. And because there's just too many different perspectives and nothing constant or controlled.
And we very much appreciate all of your perspectives today. That's Latrina Antoine. She's the editor-in-chief of Baltimore Witness. Amos Gelb is the publisher and founder of Baltimore Witness. Dr. Jeffrey Butts, the director of the Research and Evaluation Center at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Thanks to all of you. That's it for our program today. We are at the end of midday, but our fall membership campaign is just getting started. Here's WIPR's program director, Andy Bienstock, to remind us how important it is to not just be a listener, but to be a member of your public radio.
It's not just important, Tom. It's essential. Staying in touch with the latest news has never been more essential than it is right now. You count on public radio to keep you in the know. Whether it's the latest on schools opening for the fall, the latest on the ongoing efforts to get everyone vaccinated, the latest on violence suppression. Members make all of this possible. And on this first day of our fall pledge drive, we've made it easy for you to become a member or to make an additional gift. Contribute what works for you at WYPR.org. $10 a month is a great place to start, but really, anything works. WYPR.org/donate or 410-235-1395.